You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. If you've ever cursed those little stickers on your apples or wished for a sensor that would tell you whether that cantaloupe is actually ripe, well, we have news for you. Researchers at Rice University have developed a technique that they say could solve both of those problems. The key is using lasers to create designs on food out of a form of carbon known as graphene. James Tour is a professor of chemistry, computer science, and material science and nanoengineering at Rice University. Jim, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you.
All right. Graphene is a form of carbon. It's related to graphite, which is pencil lead. And graphene was first isolated in 2004. That work won those two researchers the Nobel Prize. What is all the excitement about graphene?
Well, graphene is single layers of graphite. So what graphite is, it's multiple layers stacked up. And when you write, for example, with a pencil, those come shearing off and leave the mark on the paper. But graphene itself, even as single atomic layers, is stable in air, and it conducts electricity. So we can take advantage of that. And everything that we have seen, there's been no toxicity from graphene. And it conducts electricity, and it has very high what's called mobility, allowing information to move very rapidly through the structure. Because if you make a device out of something, you can't put more information into it until the first information has gotten out. So you need it to move through very, very quickly, and it can allow the passage of information much faster than silicon. And so it has these enormous properties that are attractive to people, extremely strong, even though it's only one atom thick.
What you've been doing is creating graphene using lasers and creating graphene out of material that already has carbon in it, like food. It's not like you're printing this on there, right? You're actually using lasers to turn the surface of the food into graphene.
That is correct. We use the food itself is made out of carbon. The reason why we eat things that are made out of carbon is because we ourselves are made out of carbon. And so that nourishes us. We don't eat sand because we're not made out of silicon. So we eat food because it's made out of carbon. And so what the laser does, if we tune it correctly, it will convert that food carbon source into graphene. And so we can have the laser write patterns extremely quickly. Now we just use a typical laser writing, laser rastering system, but this could be done industrially very quickly as the food goes by.
I understand a few years ago you actually turned some Girl Scout cookies into graphene. I'm assuming that this new publication and the technique that you're working with right now is perhaps a refinement of that initial technique, yes?
Right. So formerly, we converted carbon sources into graphene, heating them up to 1,000 degrees on a copper substrate, and we got graphene to form. But you need it 1,000 degrees, so certainly food does not stay around at 1,000 degrees. All of that would go away, and whatever carbon there was, it was converted into graphene. But using this laser technique, we can have our cake and eat it too. We can just write on the surface of the food and still have the food. So it just reacts on the surface, and it's all done such that the food remains at the same temperature. It's just right at that surface that it heats up with the laser, but the rest of the food remains the same.
I'm talking with James Tour of Rice University about his technique for using lasers to create graphene designs on food. I saw when Rice University put out their press release announcing this new research used the phrase edible electronics, and my first response was, why on earth would I ever want to eat electronics? So why would we want to do this? What could we do with graphene patterns on the surface of food?
Right. So there's always a question, where does the food come from? From what field? From what source? And where has it traversed along that path to the point where it reaches our table and our mouths? So what one can do is to mark the food early on with something like an RFID tag that would then record exactly what field it came from and every point along the pathway that it went. If we built into this a sensor, then we could tell at what temperature ranges this food has been to, because there are some foods that are perishable and shouldn't be elevated above a certain temperature. And so we could build sensors in this way, so you could have an immediate readout of the food that tells you, okay, this is okay, it hasn't exceeded such and such a temperature, or it hasn't been frozen. Sometimes you wonder, is it really fresh meat, or has it been frozen and then being thawed out and then making it to the store? So this could tell you that. It could also tell you, if you build sensors into it, is there E. coli? Are there organisms living on this that you'd rather not eat? And so when, if you have embedded sensors right on the food, then it can go from the farm to the table, and you have all that embedded information. And graphene being just carbon, of course, we would have to do more toxicity tests, but it's unlikely to be toxic. It's been used medically in many applications and shown no toxicity, but still more of that would have to be done. But that's the impetus.
I have to wonder if it changes the flavor of the food at all. I mean, if you burn your toast, clearly it tastes differently. Have you tried eating any of this? Does it taste different?
No, we've not tried eating it. We're not allowed to. I can't encourage my students to do that. Now, students may have tried it themselves without telling me, but I'm not supposed to listen to that information, even if it's told to me. So I don't really know. My guess is this is just a very thin layer. It's about a 20 micron layer over a very small area. So if you're going to taste it, you'd have to be quite deliberate in only taking that very small area and really allowing it to work on your palate, because it's just a very small amount of material. But it would probably taste something like a burnt material, because what we do is we intentionally have the laser first convert it into amorphous carbon, which is very much like burning it. In fact, you could take a piece of bread, for example, and intentionally burn it in a toaster to make it blackened, and then directly make the graphene from that. So it's a two-step process, but all done in a few milliseconds with a laser. And so my guess is it's just going to taste like a small amount of the charred material.
How expensive is this process, and how realistic is it to think that farmers around the world are going to be laser imprinting produce with graphene sensors?
Well, as far as labeling with lasers, that's done already. You know, every high quality apple that comes from the store has a little sticker on it. So there's a machine that's placing a sticker. In the same amount of time, a machine could write a little pattern. And this laser scribing is already done on bottles and many, many items that flow through very quickly. So it's easy to write a pattern to mark it where it came from. But if you want to build a device, that's a little bit more involved. You'd have to have the laser draw the antenna for the RFID tag, and you'd have to have some transistors built right into it. But again, these sort of things can be done. If there's a will to do it, it can be done, and my guess is it's not going to cost very much. In fact, a typical RFID tag, if you can make them for less than 3 cents per tag, big manufacturers have said that they'll put it on every item in their warehouses at that price. And so with the laser, it's certainly going to be much less than 3 cents. There's going to be other steps involved in making the true device, but it could be done.
My guest is James Tour of Rice University, and we're talking about his technique for using lasers to create graphene labels or sensors on food. James, this is, pretty pure chemistry, physical chemistry that you're talking about here, and every scientist is entitled to his or her own personal beliefs, but your religious beliefs, and in particular your opinions and skepticism about mainstream theory of evolution and evolutionary biology, have been public and controversial. How do your beliefs affect or intersect with your research?
There's two different pieces of this that I've been quite vocal on. I've been more vocal on the origin of life, that scientists are utterly clueless on life's origin. Molecules never have been shown to assemble in anything directed toward life, never. And so somehow we've got to get all of these different components put together. So the only time I ever write on this, I write on this topic, and I never mention God or an intelligent designer or a creator. I just use science itself to show the problems with the science behind it. It's the same when I speak about evolution, where I'm crying out for a mechanism. I understand what people are talking about, but there is no mechanism that can be shown to me that shows how you change one structure massively into another. So where does my faith intersect with this? I have faith that Jesus is the Son of God and that he's risen from the dead. That is based purely on faith. I have no scientific evidence for this. There is good historical evidence for this, but it's not something I can put under my microscope. As far as this affecting my research, what I do is I pray for discernment, I pray for clarity, and I pray for creativity. And I just trust God that he'll give me that creativity. But I'm not praying that something will work for me that wouldn't work for anybody else, because then I'm in trouble. In science, I have to be able to do things that everyone else can reproduce. But that's the intersection. And for me, there's never been a conflict between the two.
You don't mention God explicitly, but it seems like a strong implication that you think that biology and chemistry are not sufficient to explain the diversity of life on Earth. Are you essentially implicating God in some way?
Well, I mean, some people think that I am. So when I write professionally on this topic, I merely show the insufficiency of chemistry and biology to address this. And I say that one day it may well be addressed. And even if it is addressed, it doesn't take away from the magnanimity of God. It just says, okay, now we understand how he must have done it. But for where we are right now, just for me, I just don't see the chemistry behind this. Biologists seem quite content. But for those of us who build molecules for a living, it's a much harder thing to see. The implications that I make professionally never presuppose a God behind this. What I have personally is, of course, there's a God behind this. But I do segment the two, because if I bring God into the professional world, then it's a very easy argument to dismiss. And I don't want my colleagues to have an easy way out of dismissing it. I'd like them to have to confront this using science.
James Tour is a professor of chemistry, computer science, materials science, and nanoengineering at Rice University. Jim, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Up next, using mindfulness to combat addiction of all sorts. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.